Okay, is this working? Yep, it is. Okay. My session is going to be a little bit different because it really is in the italics up the top there. It's a clarion call, really, is what my session's really going to be about. And so I'm going to be speaking out of some research and some work that I've done over the last few years, in regards to this issue of slavery and human trafficking in New Zealand. Just as a bit of a quick sideline, I'm really interested about the radio work, because I think in terms of trying to communicate to communities, Indian communities in this context, around people's human rights and their ability to be able to get help in regards to particularly this area of worker exploitation is something that I'd love to talk to you guys about. And what really pricked my ears up was Te Puke, because I've spent many days and weeks in that particular community. But I can't tell you that I've done that on some research that is actually now before government. So, so before I start, I'd like to begin with a bit of a laugh, but seriousness all at the same time. And that is an interview that I had with Paul Henry, or Paul Henry had an interview with me. Now, just to set this up, a lot of people will be either hot or absolutely cold on Paul Henry. but I would have to say, out of all the media that I've been involved in over the last 4 or 5 years, he is outstanding. And when it comes to causes like this, there is actually nobody better that I've actually engaged with in the media. And I've spent a lot of time talking to a lot of people. So I thought I'd show you the interview that I had last year. I had the privilege of being interviewed again by him on his last week in broadcasting in New Zealand. But this one is the one that was just before that. So let's have a look.
Paul Henry. Right, 13 minutes past 7. Great to have you with us. So we have our first conviction for human trafficking in New Zealand. Joining me now, Stand Against Slavery CEO, Peter Mihaire. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. You know, when I heard this story, my first reaction was disbelief, not that this is going on, but that it's taken so long to actually get a conviction in this area in New Zealand.
Yeah, I think anecdotal evidence would say that we've had an issue around slavery for quite a number of years. The problem is it's a very complex issue, particularly when it's related to bringing people across borders from, particularly in the case of New Zealand, it's predominantly migrant communities being brought into New Zealand. So it's very, very tricky and very, very hard, but I'm equally surprised it's taken so long, but I'm delighted that finally we've actually put a stake in the ground and say, well, now we've got our first conviction, now let's get on to some serious business and sorting this out.
You know, there's no way of knowing how much of this is going on in the country, obviously, because it's not proven, and of course it's happening undercover. Do you have any idea?
In blunt terms, no. I don't think we do know. We haven't got any evidence-based research. There is research going on at the moment. Auckland University has been sponsored to do some research on this, and we should know by the end of the year some indication, but there's a lot more research to be done. It's all anecdotal at the moment.
But that's how you find out about these things, isn't it? And I know, going back, maybe not decades, but certainly a decade in this country, there was evidence that there were people here working as sex slaves, which fits into one of the categories under this.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, definitely there's been that. I mean, predominantly in New Zealand, it's labour, because that's, you know, I mean, sex slavery is definitely here, but it's a smaller proportion. It's our primary industries. It's our export industries that actually have this exploitation going on in their industries, and that's because New Zealanders don't want to do the work. So people from other countries do, and they come and they get exploited.
And that's what human trafficking is about. Now, the areas that we're talking mostly, agriculture, hospitality, farming, nursing, and the sex trade.
Yep.
Is it possible? I mean, there'll be people listening to us and watching us now in some of those areas who might have suspicions that some of the people that they're working with are being mistreated and perhaps fit into this category?
Yeah, there is a difference between being mistreated, maybe not getting quite the wages that they're supposed to, as opposed to the acute end when there is absolute and deliberate exploitation. You know, pizza parlours around New Zealand where the owners are holding people in their restaurants make the pizzas and not letting them out. Aged care, child care, the courier industry. So, I mean, this is quite widespread, but...
And as you say, it's at the extreme end. Yeah. For people that don't know this yarn here, because this was typical, wasn't it? This first prosecution was absolutely typical, where these people are actually held, they're almost imprisoned, and what is worse, they are charged, they are penalised financially for the right to be imprisoned.
Yes, that's right. And the pattern that I heard in court in regards to what happened with the Fijians was almost the same in terms of the pattern that happened in the Nelson trial, the first human trafficking trial last year, which didn't get the convictions. And that is, you know, lured for a job through an advertisement, pay a fee, come in here, we'll give you a visa. Hold on, the visa's not what I expected it to be. That's okay, there's a person in New Zealand that will take you, turn it into the right one, and we'll promise you New Zealand residency and all this sort of carry on. And it's just the same pattern over and over and over again.
And I mean, this is the hold, of course, that these people have. This is why these people don't report it, because at the end of the day, they realise they're here illegally, and so these people hold their entire futures in the palms of their hands.
They're held here illegally, they don't have their passport, they have a debt to get here, and then there is this innuendo that if you don't behave, your family back in your home country could be in danger.
And the true sadness here is these people have been ripped off even before they arrive, before they're given the opportunity to be mistreated here.
Yes.
They have been swindled out of money in their home country.
Oh, that's right. All for the hope, bright hope future of coming to a country like New Zealand and actually having a great life. They've been done a dinner in Fiji in this case, and then when they get here, after all the promises, it just continues on.
Do you imagine that the successful prosecution yesterday will make a difference to people who are involved in that, in those sort of operations in New Zealand?
Oh, I think this is a clear message that you've got away with it for a long time. Now, this conviction is saying it's not good enough. It's the behaviour in New Zealand is not good enough. And really, I would say, in terms of sort of the enforcement agencies who have done an amazing job in this, but it's taken time, they're out to get you. And I'm certainly there wanting to get alongside them and say, we're going to nail you.
It's great to know your eyes are across this. Peter, thank you very much for joining us. Peter Mihaly, Stand Against Slavery CEO. This is Paul Henry, right around paradise on a Friday morning. Thanks for joining us, 18 past 7. Coming up.
The news will be up next. it was a lot of fun. Actually, one of the things I enjoyed about it, I don't know if you noticed in the background, sitting in the back, was Paula Bennett and Annette King. And it was fascinating walking back out through into the back of the studio area. Annette King leaned forward because I'd met her before, and sort of said, "G'day, how you doing?" Paula Bennett looked the other way, wasn't really interested in talking to me because I was obviously pushing a hot button that isn't under her scope of responsibility, but it is her government that I was getting at. that was good. It was really good, and I've got a couple of stories I could tell you. I won't bore you with those now, but if you're interested in it, setting that interview up, literally in the as we were in the ad break, made that interview even better because of Paul Henry, as you know, has a reputation that if you don't know your stuff, he will go to you, he'll get you. But I was able to create an environment with him that we actually got on. And when I had the second interview, I got all excited about something, and I overheard him as I was walking off the studio. I said, "Wow, gee, that was good." We'd kind of built up quite a good relationship there. But New Zealand is gripped by a new phenomenon. All around the world, New Zealand is a desirable destination no matter your socioeconomic standing. As I've travelled around the globe, people have often said to me that they want to visit New Zealand. People have all come and live in New Zealand. And when I ask them, "Do you know anything about New Zealand?" often the answer is no. When I so New Zealand is a desirable destination, even if you don't know anything about us. And for migrant workers who get the opportunity to travel, to live, and to work in this country, it is a dream come true. But sadly, many do not experience the dream, but rather enter a nightmare called forced and bonded labor. According to the Trafficking in Persons report, Asian and Pacific Islanders migrate to New Zealand to work in agriculture, horticulture, viticulture, and the hospitality sectors, and there are a whole screed more others, or as domestic workers, and are subsequently subjected to forced labour. Some foreign workers are charged excessively and escalating recruitment fees, experience unjustified salary reductions, restrictions on their movement, and have their passports confiscated and contracts altered. Some migrant workers are also forced to work in job conditions that are different from what they were promised during their recruitment, but do not complain because they are afraid of losing their temporary work visas. That was quoted out of the US State Department's tip report. Now, this tip report is considered the world's most comprehensive resource of governmental anti-human trafficking efforts and takes a global look at the nature and scope of trafficking in persons and the broad range of government agencies' response to confront and eliminate it. So it's a pretty powerful report. And actually in 2015, I got wind of the fact that New Zealand were potentially going to be downgraded from the number one spot, because in relative terms to the rest of the world it's quite small, to actually being downgraded. And that caused a real problem within the New Zealand government in terms of they couldn't let that happen. Worried about the lack of prosecutions in New Zealand, Justice Acts New Zealand, a good friend of mine, Stephanie Lambert, you may know her, decided to look at all the laws that touch on the issue of trafficking, slavery and labour exploitation in New Zealand to see if there were issues with the legislation making it difficult for trafficking to be prosecuted. She finished that report in 2014 and had that published. Among the findings were inconsistency with international protocols, lack of empowering in legislation, legal issues with contracts for services and employment agreements, lack of training and resourcing of government agencies, poor victim support services, and issues with access to justice for victims. Highlighted in the report were issues in the fisheries, agriculture, construction and horticulture industries where labour exploitation was clearly evident, predominantly with migrant communities. This is New Zealand. This is Aotearoa, New Zealand. In one of New Zealand's most significant export arenas, the kiwi fruit industry, severe labour exploitation has once again been raised in the media over and over again over the last 4 or 5 years. In 2014, there was an article in what was called the Sun Live, where an Indian administrator, his name is Hardeep Singh, refused to sign a letter falsifying to the Inland Revenue Department that all of his employers' workers were paid according to the law, when clearly they weren't. This action caused him, the newspaper article actually said that this action caused him to be demoted and stopped getting paid for his work, and he eventually quit. Well, I've interviewed Hardeep Singh, and it was more than that. He was taken out to an orchard and nearly beaten to death because of what he didn't do. Again, this is Aotearoa, New Zealand. And there is a growing list of incidents of forced and bonded migrant labour in New Zealand. This issue has now surfaced in such a fashion that we are beginning to understand, we're beginning to awaken as a nation, the magnitude of the problem. It converged, as I mentioned in that interview, with two people in August 2014 being charged with human trafficking. That particular trial, I sat through the whole 6 weeks of the trial, and it was a debacle. And it didn't actually, a conviction wasn't actually drawn from it, and the three people that were on trial, two people on trafficking charges were found not guilty. One of them and another person was charged on immigration charges around falsifying documents around refugee status forms. And one of them went to prison for 9 or 10 months. But it wasn't until last year when Ali Faraz, which was the precursor to getting me on the show, Ali Faraz was arrested, tried and convicted as New Zealand's first convicted human trafficker. And he is an Indian man from Fiji, and he brought people into the horticultural industry in Te Puke for that. And so here we find in this climate this organisation called Stand Against Slavery, of which I have the privilege of founding and leading. And it's a ministry birthed out of the church. It's a ministry that's birthed out of the Baptist churches of New Zealand in 2013, and is positioned to assist on a number of fronts. I mean, we gather around a common belief that all human beings are made in the image of the Creator God. That's stated in our purpose statement. It follows then that every human being has certain unalienable rights that should never be contravened. We believe the chief among those is the right to be free. We also believe that the only way to rid our world of the tyranny of slavery is for those with power to work together for those who are yet to have power. Our purpose, therefore, is to stand together for as long as necessary to see a slave-free world. In fact, I said this to my daughter. There's one day that we shouldn't have to have Stand Against Slavery. We should be able to shut the doors down because it's no longer needed. We no longer need to stand against slavery, because what is slavery? It was a thing that used to happen. Specifically, we believe that New Zealand can become the first country in the world to be truly slave-free. Now, there's an irony in all of this, because most people, when you talk to them, they go, slavery in New Zealand? There's no slavery in New Zealand. So how, of course we're the first country to be slave-free, because there is no slavery. And then you begin to unpack the reality of that. Inherent in the gospel mandate is the call for followers of Jesus to care and protect for the vulnerable. We all know this. It is therefore my thesis that Jesus mandates the body of Christ, the best equipped and strategically located group in the community, to provide support for victims and survivors of forced and bonded migrant labour in New Zealand. And as a ministry of the church, we want to equip and provide the necessary tools, that resources to mobilise a Christian response. And so the rest of this plenary paper, I guess, or presentation, is featured around two things: missiological assessment and then a missiological proposal. Sorry if it's all a bit academic. But I think sometimes in these plenary sessions we need to actually pause and actually do some thinking around this. So let's start with a missiological assessment. Now, you've had this quote sitting up above you, which is Jimmy, a president, US, former US, former US President Jimmy Carter, when he was receiving his Nobel Peace Prize, he said this: at the beginning of this new millennium, I was asked to discuss here in Oslo the greatest challenge the world faces among all the possible choices. And can you imagine what that task would have been like to do? I decided that the most serious and universal problem is the growing chasm between the richest and the poorest people on earth. And when we think about the last couple of months of the election cycle, this has been something that's been up there for discussion, and I think it's something that we need to seriously think about. The world is waking up to the reality of modern slavery and is fast becoming the justice issue of the 21st century, in my humble opinion. It is helpful to examine what the church is doing in light of the profundity of this quote. Because the owning of slaves or the exploitation of workers through forced and bonded migrant labour drives at the very heart of slavery and human trafficking. And I think it drives also this wedge around this gap between the richest and poorest people on earth. So inevitably this leads to a number of questions that I think need to be aimed at the church, and these are simply this. what is and should be the response from the church? What is the church in New Zealand doing? And what are we doing in the task of abolishing force and bonded migrant labour in New Zealand? Now, to answer these questions, it is important to observe this from the macro perspective before assessing the specificity of forced and bonded migrant labour. In March 2014, the Global Freedom Network was launched by the Pope. This was an unprecedented agreement among representatives of major faiths. The joint statement of the Global Freedom Network signatories underscored the searing, this is quoted out of their statement, underscored the searing personal destructiveness of modern slavery and human trafficking and called for urgent action by all other Christian churches and global faiths. The Global Freedom Network is an open association, and other faith leaders will be invited to join in. And it is an open invitation to support this initiative. And since the launch, this initiative has been joined by a whole lot of organisations and faith groups across the globe, and represents the Christian, Catholic, Anglican and Orthodox churches, as well as Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish and Muslim faiths, who have jointly declared one humanitarian endeavour to eradicate modern slavery by 2020, although they've adjusted that now to 2025, throughout our world and for all time as a crime against humanity. I happened to be on holiday in Europe at the beginning of the year, and while I was in Rome, I got to pop in and see a fellow Kiwi at the Anglican Centre, where the Reverend David Moxham he's the Archbishop of Canterbury's representative to the Pope. So I got to have a chat to him, and he's got a fascinating story about how Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Pope, when they decided to set up this Global Freedom Network. I'm wanting to grab an interview with David when he gets back to New Zealand to see if he can't articulate this story, because I think it's really helpful for us to understand that these kind of leaders are seeing how important this is. This action by faith leaders around the world, particularly this Christian response, fits well within the biblical framework of justice and the mandate of Christians to respond. South Korean pastor and author Eddie Byun, in his helpful guide, Justice Awakening, How You and Your Church Can Help End Human Trafficking, suggests that there are three places where we find God's justice. God's solution from the beginning, in other words, the cross. God's solution at the end, in other words, the judgment. And God's solution for today, the church. And we are set free across through the cross, and we will face eternal judgment in the end. These two aspects we can't control. Well, we can control in terms of our faith, but they're in God's hands. But we can contribute to the church response globally, nationally, and locally. The church in New Zealand has historically reached out to the poor and disadvantaged, both locally and globally. That's why we have this whole egalitarian sort of nature to us as Kiwis. There are many parachurch organizations that exist, having birthed out of the church at the genesis of the existence. I mean, the classic one is Tearfund. In May 1968, members of the Evangelical Alliance Relief Fund Committee, you know, they like their old long names in those days, met for the first time, determined to marry Christian compassion with practical action. In 1975, that was established here in New Zealand. In 1994, in response to the story of Hagar and in Genesis 16 and 21, Hagar International was birthed and formed and began operations in Cambodia. The New Zealand operation, established in 2008, raises awareness, money, volunteers and so on for the work that they do across Asia. And these are just two examples of a number of organizations birthed out of the church, specifically working in part or in whole for abolishing slavery and human trafficking. However, these organizations are primarily focused offshore. In fact, a good friend of mine based here in Wellington, she's doing a PhD at Victoria University, And her, she's American coming to New Zealand to do a PhD on human trafficking. And her starting thesis when I first met her was around, why is it that Kiwis are so involved, or New Zealanders are so involved in the abolition movement around the world? Who would have thought? I said, man, I hope you're going to want to. I hope you're okay about selling only 3 books out of your PhD. but what she found as she started to ask people is, and she changed it and got involved with Stand Against Slavery quite intimately in terms of understanding how we work, is she changed it to because there are so many Christians involved in this, I want to narrow it down even further. Now. Which makes it just an interesting proposition, with it being Victoria University, if you know anything about them, and in terms of being quite a liberal, secular university, and to then bring the notion of this God thing into the space and faith and all of that, and it's a real battle. But she wanted to narrow it down. And then Stand Against Slavery got involved in her study as being the principal example that they wanted to look at, because this was so important. And so we've had some wonderful dialogues as she's worked through that. Until recently, New Zealand has not been considered a country that has got a problem in this area. If you ask a person in the street about slavery, they would not consciously consider New Zealand in that conversation. They might think sex slavery, they might think Thailand or Southeast Asia, or they might think, you know, maybe, you know, what's happening in fishing, you know, their shrimps, because they've heard something about fish and shrimps and Thailand and Asia and that sort of thing. Or they'll think of more historical thinking. This view would be confirmed if that same question was asked probably within the church here in New Zealand as well. Unless, of course, you know Freeset and you know a little bit more about those sorts of things. A major challenge that we've faced here in New Zealand is the dearth of information around this issue, so that we can actually, around the prevalence of slavery and human trafficking. I know when I took a sabbatical back in 2013, I asked who was then the predominant person in this issue in New Zealand, and I said, right, I've got to report back to my board at the end of my sabbatical, so give me the numbers for New Zealand. And he said, we don't have numbers for New Zealand. We just don't have them. Nobody's interested in it. Nobody's looking at it. So that sparked off a need for us to actually bring together, and we brought together 5 organizations to form a research coalition with the purpose of engaging in evidence-based research to determine the size of the problem in New Zealand. At the time, the Global Slavery Index had indicated we might have had about 600. It's currently saying we've got about 800. But we already know that in one industry alone that has been heavily researched, there's a minimum of 1,200 slaves in that industry, in the fishing industry. So, and then some of the work I've been doing in the last few months would indicate, yeah, 800 is nowhere near the figure. I hate to put numbers on it because we just don't know. When I was asked the second question in that interview, is, so how do you know the prevalence? And my answer was, honestly, I don't know. That question was asked of me in the pre-interviews the night before, and they were drilling me because they wanted to make sure that I knew what I was talking about. And when I said, look, I'm sorry, I don't have a number, I kind of knew, Paul, if there was anything he was going to hang me on, it was going to be that one question. Because they were really wanting to know whether I was just some churchy fella trying to get on TV, or it was somebody who was actually trying to advance this cause. So the numbers are all over the place and more than what has been currently published. Now, whilst the church's limited involvement over the years in respect to forced and bonded migrant labour in New Zealand, there has been some activity. Very little, but some activity. The most notable came in June 2011, when an Anglican church in Christchurch in Lyttelton Harbour became a place of refuge for 32 Indonesian men who escaped their boat, the Oang 75 fishermen, because of abuse and slave-like conditions. At the outset, this little church provided support, food and shelter. And this is really captured well in a video animate kind of describing kind of a thing, their involvement in this. And we're going to show this as the next video, that I'd love you to just have a watch. Stop hearing me and listen to this.
When I was growing up, every Friday night was fish and chip night. At the end of a long week when you really don't feel like cooking, there's still something about putting down your $5 or $10 for two fish and a scoop. When you do that, you're buying into a lot more than just a good home brand like Watties or a greasy dinner. There's a line that travels from that greasy wrapper all the way back to the hook that the fish originally took. Actually, that hook is really a net, but there are other hooks all the way along the line. In New Zealand, lots of these nets are pulled in by foreign-owned boats chartered to New Zealand companies. So even though they're in New Zealand waters, fishing New Zealand fishing quota, they're actually little floating pieces of other countries. What this means in practice is that a New Zealand fishing company will go to a foreign country like Korea and to a foreign company in that country, like Sanjo Ouyang, for example, who in turn go to a crewing agent in their own country, who will in turn go to a manning agent in some other country that's a cheap source of labor, like Indonesia. The manning agent finds workers in poor communities by offering them good pay. People want the jobs so much they often not only pay to have them, but sometimes put up their houses and anything else they own as collateral for the work. Once on board the boat, of course, there really isn't anywhere they can go, and the abusive conditions have been well documented. Some of the crews are even not paid, which makes it slave labour conditions. The crew are supposed to have a contract with New Zealand Immigration, but in some cases the contract that the crew sees is entirely different to the contract that the New Zealand authorities see. What makes this so much more insidious is that often the New Zealand company, Korean company, and manning agent are working together. In June last year, the crew on board the Ouyang 75 ran away from their boat and sought refuge in an Anglican church in the port of Lyttelton. So our first involvement, our first goal in this was to provide support, food and shelter for the crew. In this we were really working with people that had been involved far more long term than us, like the Indonesian Society, a campaigner called Darren Colson and William Wilberforce. The Anglican churches were incredibly generous, and even though they had their own worries with a severely quake-damaged city to be concerned about, many parishes found a way to go beyond themselves in their offer of food, money, warm clothes, whatever they could. It really was the church's best response of charity, but that's the point at which we cross that line over into social justice, because the Department of Labour and at the time the Minister, the Honourable Kate Wilkinson, insisted that the crew had to go home immediately. The problem with this is that no crew caught in these circumstances that has ever gone home has ever been paid. So we had a new goal, to keep the crew here as long as possible to maintain pressure, ensure they got a fair hearing. We did this in a number of ways. We got them out in Christchurch helping clean up after the big snow. They worked in local food banks, that sort of thing. All this helped endear them to Christchurch, and it also got good media coverage for them. We organised rallies, we advocated on their behalf in interviews with the Department of Labour and various committees. At one point, Kate Wilkinson was overheard calling us a bunch of do-gooders getting in the way at a cocktail party. It's hard not to see that as a good thing. Eventually, it was announced there'd be a full independent inquiry and that PricewaterhouseCoopers would be hired to investigate the lack of pay. Because international reputation is important to New Zealand, we organised a global petition. I continued to make Official Information Act requests, phone calls, we kept an eye on the inquiry and worked hard to strengthen our relationship with other agencies involved. There was recently some extremely good news, that is that all boats fishing in New Zealand waters would be required to re-flag. This means they would no longer be little floating pieces of another country, but that they would be under New Zealand law, meaning the people on the boats would be subject to the same labour conditions health and safety and protection as anyone working in New Zealand. We sent the minister responsible a big bunch of flowers because thanks. She didn't reply though. It is worth remembering that the crew is still unpaid, so there's still a lot to be done. At the moment, the Christchurch Diocese, Slave Free Seas and the UNIAP are working to monitor just how bad the problem is globally and to research the possibility of a certification process to prove the supply chain of the fish is slave free, so you and William Wilberforce can rest easy when you go down to the fish and chip shop on a Friday night that your fish is not caught by slaves. There's obviously a lot more to be done.
And Julian, who is quite a strong social justice advocate through for the Anglicans in Christchurch, is pulling together a whole bunch of people with law backgrounds to try and think about what the legislation should be in New Zealand and does it need to improve and so on. In September of 2014, I addressed the National Church Leaders of Aotearoa. It's a group that gets together a couple of times a year, and I had the opportunity to say a few things, and in that I said, where should we look first? I believe it is the church. Outside of government, the church provides the greatest level of community services in our nation, and it is mandated by Jesus to do so. And so I sort of put out there, I said, we need a clarion call as the body of Christ to take in the enslaved, as well as the hungry and the poor and the sick and the naked and the imprisoned and the widow. There are people trapped in physical slavery in our communities, and we as the church need to wake up to the reality that there are more desperate people out there that need our help. We know how to help people. We know how to do this. And now our boundaries, our borders, perhaps we could biblically say our tent pegs, have been extended and enlarged. And I believe without a shadow of doubt that the church can respond effectively, and I call this body of leaders that we need to make that happen. You know, that was September 2014, and I know that they have a lot on their mind, so this is not a full-blown criticism. But they asked us to put together some goals and some thoughts, and Ian McInnes and Tear Fund and myself got together and we said, well, how do we make it nice and easy for them? Really easy. And so we presented it to them, and what are we? We're September, October 2017, and the voice of the church is not heard. And so this brings us to this whole idea of maybe we need to think of a missional proposal. You know, one day I sat across from my desk from Alistair. He's a senior manager for compliance and border control at Immigration of New Zealand. And I asked him what care is given by immigration to victims of forced and bonded labour, particularly those who require repatriation, in other words, get kicked out of the country. And the motive, I had a motive behind the question, and I said, so walk me through it. And he said, look, okay, so what happens is we take them to the airport, next available flight, they go in, we hand over to the officials in the country of origin, let's say it's the Philippines, so in the Philippines it's hand over to authorities, and then, in a sense, our responsibility has concluded. And it's all in agreement with the government. I said, yeah, I understand that process. But part of my question is more about what care is given to them. What safety do those people have when they arrive back into their home country? And he said, well, we have this relationship with government to government. Yeah, but can you put your hand on your heart in front of me right now and say those people are safe? And he said, no, I can't. And I said, would it surprise you that I could guarantee that safety? And he said, there's no way you could. And how could you do that? I said, well, I'm part of a network called the church. And I could three phone calls or emails, within three iterations of me being a known of a deportation, I could ensure no matter what port it is in the world, I could make sure there was somebody that was correctly there. Because I know I have good relationships with all the mission agencies. So I would just ring all the general directors of all the mission agencies and say, who do you know in, pick a port, you know, who do you know in Abu Dhabi that we could actually access and get, make sure they're at the airport to protect these people. And if they, if those people that you know don't know, who do they know? So within three clicks. And he, and this guy from immigration just sort of sat there dumbfounded to think that actually there is a network not only that can do that around the world. I said, and equally that same network is in our every single community in New Zealand. You see, if the church, both local and global, is prepared to extend its tent pegs, as I advocated to the national church leaders, for victim support and advocacy of forced and bonded migrant labour in New Zealand, I believe we can go a long way to abolishing slavery and human trafficking in this country. Now, it requires a church to embark on a four-part journey, I believe. Every church needs to be, number one, biblically compassionate. It needs to be abolition awakened. It needs to be migrant friendly. And it needs to be first responders in the event of a need in the community. And we need to prepare for it. How many of us got a shocking call on their iPhone the other morning? Three times, actually. Hands up, those who got? Yeah. Just about freaked me out. I mean, it freaked me out so much, it freaked my wife out that I got freaked out. So this is the civil defense. We're doing some testing, and apparently somewhere in the world, and they screwed it up, and they actually rang real people as they were testing our system. But what they're doing is they're, and there was a whole heap of barrage of communication saying how terrible it is, and anger. I didn't have a problem with it, because I thought, well, they've got to test it sometime. And it's probably, they shouldn't, you know, it's not the sort of thing you say, oh, by the way, we're having a fire alert. So everybody knows, right? So it had to be done something like that. And I thought, hey, I don't have a problem with it. But a lot of other people did. But they're doing it so that we're in preparation, so that when the time comes, and suddenly my phone goes off and everybody's phone goes off and say, there's a tsunami coming or whatever it is, then we're able to respond. And I think that the church needs to in this particular area. So let's work through all four of those. Becoming a compassionate to the core church. Now, I've borrowed this phrase from Arola Sutter in her book, The Invisible, What the Church Can Do to Find and Serve the Least of These, who categorizes churches into three broad groups. Number one, personal piety church, that focuses on almost exclusively on personal evangelism and personal growth. The social justice committee church, where the church recognizes compassion and justice as important, but relegates it to a mission, to one of the ministries of the church. And the third group, which he's advocating for, from which I've got this term compassionate to the core. This is the church in which compassion, reconciliation, and justice are core values that permeate every aspect of the church life, of church life. The compassionate to the core church requires leaders to understand and embrace the centrality of God's heart for justice and their understanding of the good news of the good news of the gospel, and impart that understanding to every ministry person across the church. And I know this may start to people may say, well, hold on a second, we're not a social gospel and all the rest of it. Most of us who have been involved in mission know that you have to start where people are at. And it is no longer saying you give your life to Jesus and everything else will be sorted out. It's just such a naive notion these days. Yeah, I hope I haven't offended anybody. So there is this, you know, justice and righteousness, this whole idea of the theology around mission. It's two faces of the same coin, and we've just got to get back to stop dissecting it and moving it apart, this whole proclamation versus demonstration. I mean, David Bosch, in his significant work, Transforming Mission, Paradigm Shifts in Theology of Mission, wrestles with this issue as one of, and he refers to it as one of the thorniest areas of theology and practice of mission. Michael Frost, who draws heavily from Bosch in his book, The Road to Missional the journey of the center of the church, advocates it is impossible to separate the announcement of God's reign and from its demonstration. And when I look at Jesus, when I read the Gospels, and when I see what he's teaching, there is as much demonstration as there is proclamation. And in fact, in some cases, proclamation doesn't come until afterwards. You think of the guy, the man at the well for 30 years. He goes off. He didn't talk about, he doesn't talk about, you know, the four spiritual laws and the, you know, salvation. He talks about that later. And there's a couple of situations like that. Once the church makes the theological transition, I believe they are better able to move to the next phase of the journey and with confidence, and that's becoming abolition awakened. And what I'm not advocating is for you to ditch all of your other community ministries. I'm coming to tell you, you need to stretch your tent pegs wider. And I know that's a real hard these days for churches, but there are vulnerable people in this community, in your community, in this area, that may need your help. So, two, become an abolition awakened church. Having chosen the path of becoming compassionate to the core church, knowledge becomes a critical ingredient in order to understand the world of slavery, forced and bonded labor, exploitation, and human trafficking. And that's where learning needs to come, and understanding it from a New Zealand perspective in terms of the migrant perspective. There was a report that came out into a medical journal just this week about how there is a need to recognize that slavery human trafficking is a public health issue. And it's public health doctors and nurses and frontline staff who are in a position to absolutely observe when exploitation is happening. It's not that dissimilar to all the training that I understand has been going on about being able to identify domestic violence. There is not that long an arc to stretch across to maybe this is not domestic violence or abuse, maybe this is something else. And so I believe that knowledge now becomes really important. We need to know what drives people to come to the country like New Zealand and accept being forced and coerced into labour that is illegal. What is it like to come from a corrupt society into a society like New Zealand? And why don't migrant people ask for help? I mean, the experience with the Anglican Church and Christchurch is a model that we need to consider. And then thirdly, we need to become a migrant-friendly church. Unique to the issue of forced and bonded migrant labour in New Zealand is the need to fully understand ethnic diversity in the local community of the local church. So what is that for this church in this immediate area? Those churches who are already compassionate to the core probably already know that. And they understand the diversity of their community, and maybe a little further down the journey when it comes to embracing the community. But there is a difference when engaging with migrant communities. Samuel Escobar wrote an article, Mission Fields on the Move, and he highlights the complexity of migration and the transition of people from one culture to another. Migrant communities are often closed communities because of culture and language, and it is important that churches do their best to develop friendly associations in their area. I mean, the studies that I've been doing in the Bay of Plenty, there are closed Indian communities there, particularly in the Sikh community, and it is almost like the mafia in terms of what's going on. And you have no idea the amount of cash that flows through that community. And you have to ask yourself the question, where did that originate from? And how did somebody be able to pay cash? And I don't mean cash as in writing a check out. I mean cash as in folding to buy a $1.3 million kiwifruit farm orchard. It doesn't take much to add up and go, there's something wrong here. But finding that out, very, very complex, very, very difficult. Most migrant communities... But what I would say is most migrant communities have a Christian presence in New Zealand. I mean, we just heard in this last session about what's been happening, and also this morning. And we are planning to, you know, and we need to build a directory of connections into migrant communities where people across the country can develop relationships and be resourced directly. And then fourthly, we need to become a first response church. As a church develops its compassion in its core, abolition awakening and migrant friendliness, it is critical to move into action, or at the very least, be ready for action. This will be done by establishing a first response team to be ready to assist vulnerable migrant workers. And it's actually not that extra hard. It's a little bit like what was said this morning, you know. Just have coffee, get to know people, you know. It's actually about what we're mandated to do about loving our neighbour. That's a good start, so that we're able to assist vulnerable communities. And I think what Jolyon White from the Anglicans sort of unpacked in the sense that there are two levels of assistance that the church can respond to. The first is the immediate response of support, food and shelter. That's easy. That we know how to do that. And every church community can provide that basic level. But the other is the assistance of advocacy, is beginning to look at that. And one of the things that I've probably spent most of my time in the last 4 years doing is actually building up relationships with business and with government agencies. And it's headbanging at times, but it's all in order so that there are a number of tentacles in to those sorts of places, particularly within government agencies, that can trigger something. And to give you an example, I from time to time will get a phone call by somebody who says they've seen something or thinks they've had something done to them in regards to exploitation. And once you've wheedled out all the ones that they just didn't get their holiday pay, I say, well, go and sort it out. I'm not interested in those ones. I'm interested in the more acute level. I can make phone calls now down into government and just talk to specific people and say, got a hypothesis for you. What would you do in this particular situation? What would you say is this person's next step? And being able to have that. Now, that's important relationships to have so that we can resource our churches more and more, whether it's New Zealand Police, Immigration, the Labour Inspectorate, and so on. I'm part of the consulting group on people trafficking, which is a formal group of the interagency working group on this issue in New Zealand with government agencies and the NGO community. And that's why on Monday I've got a meeting with them on Monday. And we're all going to look at each other and go, well, which side are we going to be sort of channeling our resources to, unless Winston Peters makes a decision today. but all that's about keeping in there and keeping those relationships developing there. And it creates a platform for dialogue that will eventually help. So let me finish. And let me finish with just, I think this is profound from David Bosch. He profoundly advocates that there is in Jesus' ministry no tension between saving from sin and savings from physical ailment, between spiritual and social. The same applies to the term forgiveness. It includes a wide variety of meanings, from being free from bonded slaves to cancellation of monetary debts to eschatological liberation and the forgiveness of sins. All shades of meaning of these terms give expression to the all-embracing nature of God's reign. It follows, therefore, that when the church is compassionate to the core, abolition awakened, migrant-friendly and equipped with first responders, they are being missional. When Jesus entered the synagogue and stood up and asked for the scroll from the prophet Isaiah and read those familiar words we all know, he declared why he was declaring the year of the Lord's favor. When the church is able to reach into vulnerable communities in their neighborhood and in particular those who are captived and forced and bonded by migrant labor, they are also declaring the Lord's favor. Brooke Fraser traveled, we know her and her songs. She traveled to Rwanda to see poverty and devastation with her own eyes in that war-torn country. She wrote a song called Albertine, in which she wrote Wilberforce-like lyrics. Now that I have seen, I am responsible. And it resonates strongly. Further in the song, she sings, I will tell the world. I will tell them where I've been. I will keep my world. I will tell them Albertine. As a missional response to forced and bonded migrant labor in New Zealand, I believe, even if I'm the only one, that the church needs to be moved deeply to do likewise. Thanks for listening.